Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Take that, Skeletor. That's right, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. I have the power. But sadly, even animated He-Man didn't have the power to sustain his own TV show beyond two seasons back in the 1980s. And evil old Skeletor has been replaced by much more powerful, or at least scarier, bad guys. There are planet destroyers in our midst. They are powerful. There are more than 6 billion of them, and they are us. We will look at how 2014 has come in as the hottest year on record in the latest gauge of the global average temperature. In the oceans is where most of the warming occurred, which accelerates the impact planet-wide. We will note how the patient power of Cuba's Fidel Castro has managed to outlast 50 years of an American embargo, only to soon see U.S. tourists flocking back across the Straits of Florida. And we will note David Bowie's incredible staying power for just a moment this hour. But first, consider the power of humanity or the forces behind the latest data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that the temperatures are rising. 2014, the warmest year on record since record keeping began in 1880. December alone was the hottest month. NASA scientists independently analyzed the data and reached the same conclusions. Today's news comes on the heels of a damning report yesterday in the journal Science, which found that humans may be causing irreversible damage to the oceans and the animals living in it. The power of humans. With us on the line now is Dr. Christopher Field, founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology. He's co-chair of the International Panel on Climate Change. Dr. Field, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much.
How much is this data a warning sign for things to come, and did it surprise you at all?
I think the way to look at these new sets of information is that it's a reminder of how much work we have to do. In some sense, it's no surprise that we're seeing the hottest year in the record because we are warming the system, and the expectation is that it's going to get warmer until we start taking the steps to prevent that. What's surprising about this year is that in the past, every time we've had a record warm year, it's been under El Niño conditions. El Niño kind of puts a boost on the global temperature. This year we didn't have El Niño conditions, but we still saw the highest temperatures ever.
What do you make of the warming of the oceans seeming to be, at least for 2014, a little bit faster or a little bit hotter than the rate of warming on land?
We've seen a period over the last several years when the distribution of the extra heat between the oceans and the land has drifted toward the ocean in ways that we're only beginning to understand. Essentially, what's happening is that the ocean is doing a better job than we had anticipated at pulling the higher temperatures down into the water. So this is a continuation of that trend. We've done a really good job of predicting how much extra heat is in the system, and the little nuances are how much ends up in the land and how much ends up in the oceans. It doesn't have a big effect on the long-term trajectory of warming of the planet. It does have some influence on the year-to-year bumps, and it probably has some impact on the year-to-year consequences of the way that warming plays out.
But I'm thinking here, and maybe I'm putting words into your mouth, but I'm thinking here that scientists believe it's pretty dangerous to think of the oceans as some kind of a heat sink, that that's a very dangerous way of looking at the oceans because heat is very damaging to them just as much as pollution.
Over the last several years, something like 95 to 98% of the extra heat in the system has ended up in the oceans. So we know the oceans are warming strongly, and we also know that many of the organisms in the oceans are very temperature sensitive. So it's not like the oceans represent some kind of a safety valve. We have temperature systems on land, temperature sensitive systems on land, temperature sensitive species and ecosystems in the ocean as well. So extra heat is a problem, and it's a problem whether or not it's in the land or in the oceans.
The New York Times suggested, quoting a scientist here, in this data and some independent data about what's going on in the oceans, that it's beginning to look as though we're on the edge of what was described as a major extinction event. Is that to say that things could happen very rapidly in the ocean because of the nature of a water fluid system, or that there's just something going on in terms of contamination to the ocean that it feels irreversible?
This new study on the ocean pulls together wide range of different kinds of information, not only information about consequences of climate change, increases in temperature and acidification, but also consequences of changes in pressure from fishing and other ecosystem changes. And it's typical of what we see around the world that ecosystems and societies are really responding to multiple kinds of pressures. They're in a multi-stressor environment. The oceans are as well. And when you look at the precarious situation of the oceans, it's more because of this multi-stressor situation than it is because of the predominant effects of climate change or any single factor.
So that would point the finger at the habitat destruction, where you've got nets and fishing apparatus clearing coral beds and mining clearing bottom habitats. How much of this habitat is under threat right now?
When we look around the world, and in the oceans in particular, what we see is a wide range of factors that are impinging on essentially every system. So in the oceans, you can look at temperature change. You can look at the acidification that comes from the extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You can look at fishing pressures. You can look at the big expansion in underwater mining. You can look at the big expansion in coastal development and coastal runoff and pollution. And just there's a long checklist of challenges that ocean ecosystems are currently facing, and it really creates a precarious situation. One of the big challenges with the pace of change and the magnitude of the threat is it's hard to predict when things fall apart, but we know there's a lot of pressure that is leaning on the system to cause fractures.
What does this NOAA data say about the distribution of temperature change? And I'm thinking particularly about droughts in Africa and in California and the West, where people are very concerned about what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years.
You can think about the global average temperature as kind of a speedometer of the way the entire planet's going. But people don't go to the hospital or crops don't fail typically because of the average conditions. They fail because of extremes. And what we're seeing is that the average conditions are a good marker for what's happening in terms of extremes. And that includes extremes in heat waves, extremes in the length and the severity of droughts, and extremes in the fraction of the rainfall that falls in the heaviest precipitation events. Those are the kinds of conditions that really cause damages. And we've seen a continuing increase in those kinds of extremes, even as the average temperature has gone through some periods of more rapid increase and some periods of less rapid increase.
Is there anything about these data that suggests that glaciers and melting events are going to accelerate in specific terms? Is there water level indications from this 1 degree rise in the ocean, for instance?
The thing that's important to remember is that calculating how much extra heat ends up in the Earth system on a year-by-year basis is pretty straightforward. That's one of the reasons that the scientific community is so concerned about the climate change problem. Calculating how much temperature difference we see on a year-to-year basis is a much more difficult problem because it has influences from El Nino and other kinds of year-to-year variability. So it's not a surprise that we're seeing a continuous increase in temperatures. The magnitude of this one is a little bit of a surprise, and the fact that it occurs in a non-El Nino year, but it's really a reminder of how much extra heat we're putting in the system and how this extra heat is causing a wide range of impacts from melting mountain glaciers to decreases in Arctic sea ice to increases in heat waves and hot events and to increases in the length and severity of droughts. The whole package tends to go together with the extra heat in the system, and that's reflected in this global average temperature measurement.
Finally, skeptics will say, okay, you've got the increased temperature, but do you have the connection with the human activity that's causing this increased temperature? Is that in the data here, or is there anything new there?
The understanding of the link between human emissions of these heat-trapping gases and the global temperature pattern is something where the physics have been basically understood for more than 100 years. So it's not a surprise to see the temperature of the planet warming. And what's important to remember is that this is really a reminder of what we're going to need to do in order to prevent future temperature increases. At some point, we're going to have to stop emitting these heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere if we want to slow the pace of temperature increase.
Has time run out?
No, this is a problem we can solve, but we have to solve it with ambitious efforts to decrease the amount of heat-trapping gases that are released. The longer we wait, the more difficult it gets to be, the more complicated the problem gets, and the more residual impacts we're going to see.
Dr. Christopher Field, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Christopher Field is founding director of the Carnegie Institution's Department of Global Ecology and a co-chair of the International Panel on Climate Change. To see some detailed charts and graphs included in today's NOAA report, visit thetakeaway.org. Now, no one would call 21st century CEO and billionaire Mark Zuckerberg a powerful He-Man type, but he is certainly a powerful figure in social media. But what do you do with that kind of power? Well, like Oprah did many years ago, you throw your weight around by starting a book club. Oprah's book club established her clout, as if anyone was really doubting it. Zuckerberg's club comes from his 2015 resolution to read and discuss a new book every 2 weeks. That's admirable. His A Year of Books community Facebook page has more than 250,000 members, including author Moises Naim, whose book The End of Power was the first title chosen.
Oh, I was surprised. I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know that he had launched a book club, and even less, I knew that he was going to pick mine. So when I woke up early in January and I just looked at what happening, I was thrilled and overwhelmed and, of course, delighted. I don't know Mark Zuckerberg, but I am obviously immensely grateful to him.
Well, sure you are. With Zuckerberg's name behind it, this somewhat corporate-sounding academic treatise began clicking swiftly off of Amazon. But Takeaway listener Farouk Malik in San Antonio, Texas, had to sell his book to his All Women in Their 20s book club and sell it all by himself.
When I first recommended it, people's eyes glazed over a little bit. They were like, what is this and why are we reading this?
But Farouk Malik managed to sell it to his skeptical club members, and then he realized that he'd been zuckered.
I guess about a week into selecting the book, one of the guys in the book club emailed me and said, well, hey, I didn't know that this book was recommended by Mark Zuckerberg. And as soon as I found out that Mark Zuckerberg had recommended this, it was almost like I didn't want to read the book anymore because I felt like it didn't feel right anymore to read a book about sort of the decay of power and sort of leadership and all of that stuff when, you know, the guy that runs the world's largest social network and has incredible amounts of influence and power over what people feel and read. If that guy's recommending a book about how power is waning and all of that stuff, then it really just doesn't seem to make much sense.
Now. Zuckerberg spoils the party. We'll talk with Moises Naim about The End of Power, that Zuckerberg choice, later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There's a power, the power of Cuba. Its culture and identity and communist government, in the end, were stronger than the U.S. embargo that was trying for 50 years to compel regime change.
Cuba es auténtica.
Authentic Cuba has been reaching out to tourists for decades, just not Americans until now. Some of the tight travel restrictions for U.S. citizens are being eased by the Obama administration this week. No advance permission required. Direct airline booking and travel must meet some cultural or educational purpose. To figure out how these lighter restrictions work, you can check with the U.S. State Department before you travel or look at the rules at thetakeaway.org. But because of the half-century embargo, U.S. tourism to Cuba is kind of a blank slate.
White sand beaches.
Deep water diving.
Dancing and drinking.
Rum, cigars, and killer vintage cars.
Art and culture.
Vibrant energy by day.
Romance by night.
Cuba. It's calling your name.
Soon Havana could be a destination like Disney, Vegas, Tahoe, and Mohegan Sun, as our little attempt at a commercial there suggests. Money will certainly be flowing to Havana, as the government has raised the cash limit from $500 to $2,000 every 3 months. Julia Cook is a journalist and author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba. Julia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So when you think about American tourism in Cuba, do you get scared of what Cuba might become? Or what sorts of discoveries and clashes of culture do you see?
I'm not scared at all. I think that we've been waiting for this for a long time, those of us who have been going to Cuba. The rest of the world has been visiting Cuba for quite some time now, since the early 90s. So we've been waiting for this.
It's a great place to go and speak German now.
Totally. A lot remains to be seen as far as how businesses are going to negotiate these new changes. But as far as people go and people visiting other people in Cuba, it's great.
Let's see about what might be the adventure you could concoct for a first adopter American who wants maybe this spring or summer to try out Cuba. What would you suggest as a landing point? Where should you go? What would you see? And how can you get a feel for both the revolution of Cuba and its traditional pre-revolutionary past?
I love Havana. I spent years in Havana, and it's one of my favorite cities in the world. It's probably my favorite city in the world.
Really?
Definitely. Yeah, it's so interesting. There are so many different layers to explore. It's such a unique contradiction in that it is so old and at the same time so contemporary. So you have this strange, what people refer to as a frozen in time feel, because of its architecture and its lacking infrastructure in many ways.
And for people who know Florida, it is the anti-Miami of Havana.
Completely.
Yeah.
But that's not because necessarily of how old it feels. That's the kind of surface version. But there's a graciousness to it and to how people are in it. Old school manners are still very important in many places. There's no internet, which is hardly a good thing for Cubans. The internet penetration in Cuba is 11%. But it results in a kind of palate cleanser for foreign tourists who are perhaps oversaturated.
But that's going to change.
It may. We hope it will.
And you start in Havana. Then where do you go?
There are a bunch of places outside of Havana that I really, really love that aren't necessarily the spots that tourists immediately think of. Vinales is a pretty well-trafficked tourist destination. It's a farming area that's 2 hours west of Havana that's dotted with these gorgeous mogotes that are limestone rock outcroppings. They're almost vertical. It's kind of a nascent rock climbing scene.
Hmm.
But it's just so slow and beautiful. It's one of the most visually stunning landscapes I've ever seen. I also really love Cienfuegos, which is a city of 150,000 on the southern coast of Cuba. It was actually initially settled by a Frenchman from Louisiana. And it's got these beautiful cake frosting, precious 19th and 20th century mansions that are really nicely preserved. But it's not as touristy as, say, Trinidad, which a lot of tourist itineraries put you in, which can feel a little cloying. There's a lot of tourist infrastructure. A lot of people are kind of out to hustle tourists. And it's a little more – Cienfuegos is a little slower. It's got that kind of – Cuban graciousness that I think people might associate with a pre-revolution era, but which is still very much alive.
Is it public transit you use? Is it rent a car?
You can rent a car. There are great tourist buses that are quite expensive, but they're really comfortable. They have the lie-back seats and whatnot. There's also, you know, for really adventurous tourists, there are a lot of different Cuban forms of transportation. When I lived there, I took a week and traveled around the country on only Cuban transportation, which meant, you know, riding in the back of modified garbage trucks and hitching rides in, you know, as a hitchhiker and, you know, going on trains that are very old and very slow. But, you know, you wind up striking up a conversation with the person across from you, and it's just a completely different way to see the city.
Now, we can talk romantically about this frozen in time old infrastructure. But I suspect as the economy begins to address some of the shortcomings that have really are part of what the embargo is all about, modernization will come to the trains and other things. Do Cubans and do you fear that?
I'm sure Cubans definitely don't. Bus service was a really big issue in Cuba, which Raul Castro actually did a lot toward fixing. When he first came into power, there weren't enough buses and they were often very overcrowded and the service was terrible. Not having a good public transportation system in an urban area of 2.1 million is pretty crazy. And he did a lot toward addressing that. He completely improved it. And that was met with nothing but gratefulness, happiness, excitement. So I don't think that we're necessarily fearing improvements in infrastructure.
Looking back at the Cold War, it does seem when you look at this particular scene of the Cold War, that there's a big get over it kind of feel. Certainly that's part of what is being said to America, you know, get over this embargo. It's outmoded. It's gone. Is there a similar argument in certain quarters inside Cuba as well, that the Castros need to kind of, you know, get over it? It's over, guys, settle. What would that sound like?
Oh, it sounds like the way everyone talks. Cubans are very savvy. They have a workaround for almost everything that they've been having to deal with for the last 50 years. They're, on the one hand, very grateful for a lot of the good things that the Castros have done, namely medicine and education. But at the same time, they're kind of like, all right, let's on to the next thing. They're already moving beyond, far beyond what they've been limited to.
What would it cost to buy a 1956 Chevy carburetor?
Oh, I have no idea. That Chevy carburetor probably has a Mitsubishi engine or a, I don't know.
Julia Cook, journalist, author of The Other Side of Paradise, Life in the New Cuba, has very fond memories of living in Cuba and is determined to go back, I suspect.
Absolutely.
Havana, your favorite place?
Definitely.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
Friday, you have reached the Friday 5 segment of our program with Sean Ramaswamy, who finds the things on the internet that you don't have the time to find because he's the host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast. Sean, welcome.
How are you, John?
Number one.
Meeting up and making plans is still really hard. And the New Yorker, actually, Kelly Stout, hit that feeling, that sentiment on the head with an article in a Shouts and Murmurs article called Let's Get Drinks.
And the premise is?
The premise is two friends are texting back and forth trying to make plans to meet up for drinks, and they can't do it, and their excuses for why they're flaking on each other keep getting more and more involved. Shall we do a little dramatization?
Give us an impression here.
Okay,
yeah.
So Jesus, I am like the Spanish Civil War, riding in a subway car with broken AC, seated between Kim Jong-un and the phrase said no one ever, but I could do coffee like midday on Tuesday.
Coffee. I'm sort of kind of trying to get off caffeine. I know. I'm worse than the Hobby Lobby verdict. Dancing with Vladimir Putin on Elaine Stritch's grave while the Vietnam War plays all about the bass on the didgeridoo. But lunch would be great.
So anyway, this thing went viral, which I think is rare for Shouts and Murmurs in the New Yorker.
Two.
Number two, the longest mixtape ever, probably. Caribou is this Canadian electronic musician. This week, he released a 1,000-song YouTube playlist of basically the songs that influenced him and made him the musician he is, from Kanye to Arthur Russell to Nina Simone. He recommends we listen to it on Shuffle, but the first song, it starts off with Minnie Riperton, a classic from her.
I love that. You know, the Rolling Stone says it's number 10, but where does it fall on the Caribou playlist?
The 1,000 Caribou playlist.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we can all make playlists like this. What would kick off yours? Do you have a song that just defines you?
And Better Man.
Pearl Jam?
Yeah.
Excellent. I'd probably start with the Bare Naked Ladies somewhere.
Really?
Yeah, but then I'd go to some crazy, crazy places, John.
We'll have you back for that. Number three,
ship your enemies glitter. This brilliant, ingenious idea from these two Australian dudes. You give them like $10 Australian, which I don't know the conversion rate on that, but they send an envelope packed with glitter and a hateful note to someone you don't like, and it's done anonymously. And the idea is they rip open the envelope, and then their life is forever ruined because they're going to be finding glitter all over their office or their home. Overnight, this thing was a sensation. The founders of the site had to like write a note saying, "Please stop ordering glitter."
A roll of duct tape can help you get that glitter off your clothes. Number four.
Have you been glittered before?
Oh, man. I have five kids. Birthday parties. Glitter.
Oh,
hello.
Yeah, true.
Four.
Number four. David Bowie recently had a birthday, and to celebrate it, a British illustrator named Helen Green made this amazing animated image of basically like Bowie's head turning on a 100-degree axis from his earliest stages basically throughout his career. And he's the perfect artist to do this with because he's had so many distinctive looks. So you've got, like, of course, you've got your Ziggy Stardust, you've got your eye patch, you've got your Labyrinth, you've got your more recent Bowie, the, like, more refined. It's amazing, and it's really done well, and you have to see it at thetakeaway.org. We got five. Number five, McConaughey didn't do the best at the Golden Globes, but this week the Criterion Collection folks, who have released a Criterion edition of Dazed and Confused, his first big role, released his audition tape from that movie where he plays, of course, Wooderson. It's classic. Let's take a look.
Say, man, you got a joint?
No, not anymore.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
It's priceless.
He nailed
about Boyhood.
He had not been an actor. The story's kind of known, but he was at a bar, met this guy who was casting for Dazed and Confused, and the guy said, "You need to come read for this part of Wooderson." And he nails the lines. And I was thinking maybe there's enough footage in these audition tapes to make like McConaughey. I'd watch that movie. Just McConaughey through the years.
Consummation devoutly to be wished. Sean Ramos, for I'm host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast you should be listening to. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, John.
Power is decaying.
Author Moises Naim watched power decay firsthand when he was a technocrat working on development issues in the He-Man government of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez.
Power is becoming easier to acquire, harder to use, and easier to lose. This is happening globally in all geographies, but it's also happening in all functionally. It's happening in big armies and big governments, in great corporations, organized religion, in big foundations, universities, wherever there is power and human organized around power, power is decaying.
Hugo Chavez fancied himself a populist whose charisma, oil wealth, and tough words for America could not forestall more powerful forces that undermined his government and eventually him. Moises Naim is now Distinguished Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His book, The End of Power, was picked by Mark Zuckerberg to inaugurate the Facebook Book Club. Naim is grateful for that, he says, but when we spoke, he told me the main question for powerful leaders is whether they can sustain their hold on people. The jury, he said, is out for Zuckerberg, but at this stage, Hugo Chavez failed.
He was a very charismatic leader that transformed the politics of his country, surely, and had international influence. But what he did was not sustainable. And his whole approach, both in terms of his politics and his economic policies, is clearly unsustainable. And now Venezuelans, especially the poor that he claimed to represent, are paying a very, very steep price for his policy mistakes.
What do you make of Mark Zuckerberg choosing your book as the Facebook sort of book club choice? Lots to talk about there.
Oh, I was surprised. I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know that he had launched a book club, and even less, I knew that he was going to pick mine. So when I woke up early in January and I just looked at what happening, I was thrilled and overwhelmed and, of course, delighted. I don't know Mark Zuckerberg, but I am obviously immensely grateful to him.
Do you think that Facebook and his role in Facebook stands in this kind of new zone for projecting and acquiring power, in that he had an idea that became a huge corporation and now he certainly projects a lot of influence? I don't know what you would think of his power.
Of course, and the book never says in the book, I don't argue that power doesn't exist or that the world doesn't have huge concentrations of power. Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Google and the government of China and Barack Obama, the White House, and of course Facebook, ExxonMobil. These are very powerful centers, the Pentagon and the Vatican. Of course they have power. What I argue, however, is that these very powerful players have faced more constraints, are more limited in what they can do with the power they have, and that their power is going to be more ephemeral.
In looking at the current headlines and what's gone on in the last year, it seems to me you could make a case that the Pentagon's power is declining while Pope Francis's power is ascending. These are two huge institutions and power centers that you've just identified. Why would you say one is going up and the other is going down based on some of the lessons that you've tried to articulate in your book?
Well, I actually argue that all institutions face the same constraints face constraints in the way they can wield power. In the case of the Pentagon, we have seen, for example, how, you know, if this conversation would have been a year or two ago, we would not be talking, for example, about ISIS. And yet ISIS came out of nowhere and became a very powerful force, transforming the politics and the security of the Middle East, at least in the part between Syria and Iraq. And Pope Francis, what he shows is the power of charisma and how he needs to revert some very powerful trends that are undermining the church. The Catholic Church is losing, you know, membership. A lot of people used to call themselves Catholics are no longer doing that. And the numbers are huge in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa. There is an international competition for a market share of souls around the world. And until Pope Francis arrived, the Catholic Church was losing market share. And I believe that thanks to his charisma and his ideas, that can be reversed. But still, the Catholic Church is also under a challenge as well as other institutions that concentrate a lot of power.
You know who Oprah Winfrey is, right?
Of course.
And, you know, she had a book club that was really influential in publishing and I think retains a certain influence now. Part of what went along with her book club was an idea of aspiration, that if you look at the or pay attention to the Oprah choice for the book club, somehow by reading this book, maybe you get closer to being like Oprah. And I'm wondering if some of that isn't going on in this Zuckerberg thing. If you read The End of Power, maybe you're going to have more of the insights that make you like Zuckerberg. Listen to this question that you got this week. Kevin Mobilade, how can young people leverage the decreasing barriers to entry in order to train themselves to think like entrepreneurs? Now, is that somebody who wants the answer to that question, or are they really asking, how can I be more like Zuckerberg?
Yeah, well, that's one way of interpreting it, an interesting one, by the way. But what I have to say is that the difference from what I gather was Oprah Winfrey, what is Oprah Winfrey's book, and what's happening in Facebook, and what has surprised me is how global it is. I have had readers now contacting me from Malaysia to Morocco and from Hungary to Thailand. It has been a truly global experience. As interesting as the aspirational dimension that you mentioned is, there is this global perspective, this global participation in a book club discussion that I think is quite unique and very interesting.
I like your book, by the way, but I have to say that I'm much less interested in what Mark Zuckerberg would choose for me to read than what you would choose for me to read. What's a book that you would recommend to me right now?
People have asked me what would I recommend to be the second book that Mark Zuckerberg would pick. And I suggested that it would be a good idea to pick a fiction book, a novel. And of course, I think a great, great novel is 100 Years of Solitude by Garcia Marquez. Those who have not read it should read it, and those who read it should read it again. You know, that's a book about a very local, very specific experience in Latin America. But it has echoes that are valid in India and in Africa and even in the United States. And so it would be wonderful to have a global conversation about a book that shows the human experience from a very local perspective, but then is universal.
Moises Naim, author of The End of Power and distinguished fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
By the way, early numbers on the Facebook book club aren't so hot. While 250,000 people signed up, the virtual meeting last week attracted fewer than 200. Maybe next time. So what other powerful forces shape your life? Perth Amboy, New Jersey. My wife. Need more of an explanation than that. Or Walnut Creek, California. My husband. With him by my side, we navigate all worldly powers as the laughing dynamic duo. He's brilliant, adorable, ethical, soulful, talented, unquestionably dependable, makes me laugh every day, and still thinks I'm hot after 15 years. Now that's real power.
Hi, this is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. My dad passed away 4 years ago, but he still remains a very powerful force behind all of my decision-making.
Share the power in your life, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.